For the second episode of mini-series Forces of Nature, we welcome Volker Tinkelsmann, CEO of Eosta and founder of Nature & More. Tune into Sourcing Matters to hear what this marketing mastermind and guru of differentiation has to say about the future of food, soil health, decommoditization, better health index, and much, much more. Volker, look at that. Welcome to my kitchen.
Wow. Good. Thank you for having me, Aaron. What a beautiful kitchen.
Isn't it nice? It's yeah. Bright and sunny. I got all kinds of fresh produce.
Nice toaster, nice espresso machine.
Thank you, sir. Thank you. Yeah. I spent a lot of time making it work. So, but look at that. Look right behind you. We have some wonderful produce, some oranges, some apples. Look at that. We all enjoy some of that. Yeah. But you know what is missing on that is the sustainability flower.
That's a good point, Aaron.
You know, I can't see it. And in stateside, I don't get that. So maybe you can start there and share with us what the sustainability flower is, what Nature & More is, and why it's so important.
Well, we believe that sustainability always starts with transparency. So we put a little stamp on each product so the consumers can see where it comes from and what the impact is on people and planet. And the sustainability flower reflects that people and planet ranking. So we talk about soil fertility, we talk about water holding capacities of soil, we talk about biodiversity, climate change, and a whole series of social elements that usually come with a product, but nobody talks about it. So consumers are kept in the dark. They have no idea where the product comes from and what the impact is on people and planet. And we thought we need to decommoditize that product flow and start individualizing the story and start storytelling again. So that's what we do.
Yeah, it's fascinating, those values being baked back into food, looking at the conditions, the environment, the social welfare side of this, all put into this single nice scorecarding tool to allow me to make better decisions. Right. Now, can you make this work from other suppliers from all over the world? And then when you bring it to your customers, they can appreciate what those values really represent? Is that the idea?
That's the idea. No, not that we are succeeding, of course, not to the extent that we would like it to succeed. But yeah, I think we're obviously a small company, all organic fruits, a few hundred million turnover, a few hundred people, supplying most of the European member states and most of the retailers, and about up to one third carries that stamp and QR code. Then there's one third that combines it with their own private label. And then there's one third that says, you know what, I want anonymous supply chains. Otherwise, I can't play you against the other in a race to the bottom for the lowest price, usually at the expense of people and planet. It's sort of a Machiavelli in practice, where you play one against the other to make food at least look cheap.
Yeah, and that's the conventional norm, right? Is the majority of it that comes through supply chains is not, it's not based on the value chain. It's really based off of one variable, and that's a price point. I mean, if it looks shiny, it looks clean, it looks, you know, in the perfect shape of that produce sitting on the grocery store shelf, then okay. But really, it doesn't get into what's the backstory, what's the origin, what is the values, what's the nutrient density, and then really what's your responsibility as the consumer. So okay, you are the guru of differentiation here. I look at that. I mean, I got to know you about 10 years ago now, maybe 7-8 years ago. And I always look up to your perspective on this. You're an innovator. You're always ahead of this. So from your point of view, are consumers making this leap, or are we still at, you know, do we still have to cross the chasm? Are we at a point where we have a majority or near majority of people intrigued by the sustainability flower or even the values, coaxing those values through supply?
It's a bit of both, I guess. Organic is growing and spectacularly growing, and the European Commission has set a target to achieve 25% market share for organic by 2030, which is in 8 years or 7 years from now. At the same time, we realize that change has always come from a trendsetting minority and will never come from a following majority. So it's really the first movers, early adopters that we are targeting, which, interesting enough, is not necessarily a financial elite, but usually an awareness elite. So not necessarily wealthy, but usually highly educated. So they would like to make an informed purchase decision and wouldn't take it for granted if they're kept in the dark. So if they're kept in the dark by a retailer, they will have questions about their health and the impact of a product or a production method on the environment or on social welfare. So we capitalize on that group. And that trendsetting minority is a leading example that basically, together with organic growers, is prototyping the new normal in which the polluter no longer gets away with a competitive advantage, because that's what's happening now. For some strange reason, we don't have a level playing field in the market. So we talk a lot about people and planet, and the importance of climate change or nutrient density or social or the wealth gap. But fundamentally, we still operate in a system that rewards short-term profit whilst depleting soils, contributing to climate change, and killing biodiversity.
Yeah.
And so if we are brutally honest, Aaron, I think, if you look at the crisis we're facing now, the environmental crisis or the widening wealth gap, then we must accept the sort of reflection that we're looking into a mirror that reflects the limitations of our own thinking. And one of your countrymen, Otto Scharmer, who's teaching at MIT, speaks of a threefold divide, the natural divide that separates us from nature, the social divide that separates us from the other, and the spiritual divide, for lack of a better word, that separates us from who we are.
Yeah.
So I think it's time for a mind shift from reductionist thinking to holistic and thinking that looks at the interconnectedness of all these things.
Right.
And that ultimately will also need to redefining profit. Now we can still sort of agree on a profit, even if people and planet are suffering and losing. But tomorrow's profit definition will include these externalities and social and environmental costs, which is precisely what's happening right now in Europe. You see that everywhere. So there's gradually descending into the DNA of financial markets and taxonomies and fiscal incentives.
So those externalities are, you know, that's a tough thing for some folks to palate, because they either want to kick the can down the road, or they don't want to admit to the fact that they have been buying those products and, you know, consuming those products for years. So as you get folks to be more enlightened, or maybe even more spiritual in the way that you're speaking to this, of this connectivity towards planet and surrounding, how are these politicians gaining awareness to these externalities? How are you able to convince them that these things matter? Because on the bottom line, you know, business as usual makes more sense. It's not as expensive to do that. You can continue to waste and put your extracts everywhere. And if it's someone else's problem, it's never land. So now, if they have to own this, who is putting their neck on the line to do that? And maybe you could share with us an example of folks that are doing it well.
I guess there's a difference in between America and Europe when it comes to that. But if you look, we've always said, you know, costs of climate change or biodiversity loss or pollution in general can be carried forward, externalized to future generations.
Yeah.
So who cares? But this boomerang seems to be coming back to us faster every year. And if you look at the nitrogen crisis, we're just in Holland spending 40 billion euros to fix a nitrogen crisis that has been caused by farmers who were led to believe that don't worry about nitrogen pollution, don't worry about polluting groundwater, don't worry about, you know, biodiversity loss, because it's the yield per hectare that counts.
Right.
And our kids can carry the costs of water pollution and nitrogen issues. But that boomerang is coming back now. So we're losing, for instance, fertile soil at a rate of 30 soccer fields per minute. And all of a sudden, people are talking about this. So to give you a practical example, Europe is now, or Brussels is now, talking about the Green Deal.
Yeah.
And the farm to fork strategy that wants to cut mineral fertilizer and pesticide use in half in 8 years from now.
Right.
You know, just not to avoid being penny wise, pound foolish.
Right.
Because if we have to repair that in 8 years, it's more expensive than if we prevent it right now.
Right.
So you see legislation kicking in, you see frameworks kicking in, you see the Corporate Sustainability Reporting Directive kicking in. Usually that's a sequence. You start with a directive, which turns into a framework, and then it turns into legislation.
Right.
And part of that Green Deal is a new taxonomy that will penalize the one who pollutes and subsidize the one who contributes to the commons, to who contributes to social or environmental values. So that's one driver. And then you see an interesting development. I don't know if you see that in the United States as well, in the financial sector, where increasingly central banks are implementing sustainability indicators in their RAROCs, in their risk-adjusted return on capital.
Yeah.
And climate stress tests is a good example.
Yeah.
So if your profit is 1,000, but your carbon footprint is 300, then even today, financial or institutional investors say, hang on a minute, I need to adjust that cash flow. Otherwise, I would be undermining my profitability in future. So if I don't address climate change right now, and then you're not even talking about the flood risks or the drought risks or the hurricane risks that are already affecting us now, but you're talking about long-term damage, then I would be penny-wise, pound-foolish. So this is not necessarily green bubble-driven. This is not necessarily legislation-driven. This is purely risk-driven.
Yeah.
So if you zoom out a little bit, you see, if you look at what is happening in the public sector, what is happening in the financial sector, and connect that with what is happening in the commercial sector, then, yeah, you can. It depends on your business proposition and how you want to position your business. If you want to focus on the laggards, I would say don't worry too much. But even then, but if you want to be ahead of the block and stay competitive in future and team up with the first movers and early adopters, then it makes total business sense to include social and environmental values in your business case and start calculating with that in your cost price and contribute to social and environmental values within your supply chain.
Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, no doubt the United States has a diverse demographic across the board, like a lot of Europe. I mean,
sure.
You know, and I swim within the same pools, I'm sure that you do, where Everything I see on every social media feed, everything that I look at is talking about these things, the people I engage with, the conversations I have. But then you go out to mainstream media and boy, nobody's, yeah. rare, fewer time. I think there are things that are starting to incubate and have further conversations, climate being a major discussion. But one of the areas that has evolved or at least come to some mainstream media is soil health. And, you know, this kind of is a bit of an incubator here for what you're speaking to. You have been involved in this for years. I mean, it's a foundational part of what Nature and Morniosta is involved in. And back in 2015, you had your Soilutions, your 2015's, the Soil Health Day, right?
Which celebrating was, soil, yeah. Save yeah, our soils. The save, sky,
absolutely.
Yeah, the soil is the limit, not the sky. And organic is probably a Soilution. And you become a, you can become a soilier. That's what we invited consumers to be. Yeah, very funny.
Fantastic. Lama, good marketing.
Yeah, it was great fun with Julia Roberts and... many thought leaders around the world.
And so that was 7 or 8 years ago. You had this kind of incubation process, people starting to becoming aware of it. I think there are now heads of states, you've got UN leaders, you've got politicians, business leaders, carbon market players that are all now jumping into soil health. But how much is that commandeering the real situation of solving those problems, getting rid of the petrochemical fertilizer, mineral fertilizers, the treatment programs of conventional agriculture, which are the antithesis of a soil health movement. And, you know, so we've got a lot of folks that are speaking a big game, maybe greenwashing where soil health is going. So how do we prevent this enthusiasm towards soil health from being commandeered by players that don't have the same ethos and engagement that someone's been at it for a decade and really looking at it in the right way? What's your advice for folks on that side of things?
Well, Aaron, you're putting your finger on the right spot. This is always where the tension is. And to be fair, also to the conventional farmers, we've been talking a lot about people and planet, but usually these farmers say, how can my how can I be green if my figures are red?
Yeah.
And it's strange that we still have this weird profit or productivity definition that's based on yield per hectare. So, you know, then you can talk, keep talking about soil health, but in the meantime, I need to survive. That's what the farmer says. So I'll have to use mineral fertilizer.
Right.
So unless we start rewarding farmers for their ecosystem services, I mean, financially rewarding, not much is going to happen, I'm afraid. It's like mopping up the floor with the tap open. So we need, which is precisely why we called a group of thought leaders together here a few weeks ago, September 24th, and launched the Business Alliance for Regenerative Agriculture.
Right.
And it's not the sort of another regenerative farming conference where we talk cleverly about how important regenerative farming is. We've been doing that for decades now, but it was mostly geared and towards those who are experimenting with carbon credits or insetting credits. I'm happy to explain that in a minute. To reward growers for their soil organic carbon built up. And that sounds like a one-dimensional issue, because what's that got to do with climate change or biodiversity or water? Well, a lot. Because whilst soil organic carbon is not saying everything, it is a quite sound indicator for soil health. And if you built your soil organic carbon, usually you built your water holding capacity and your water retention. And you usually contribute to biodiversity, because biodiversity is born out of fertile soils. And you sequester carbon dioxide from the atmosphere in soil organic matter. So we thought, if we can invent some sort of carbon credit that is based on trustworthy metrics and certified to IPCC or UNFCCC certified credits,
mm-hmm.
then we would have something that we can offer to the market, which is precisely what we did.
Hmm.
So we are prototyping the first carbon credits for soil organic carbon in South Africa right now. And with that, farmers are not only rewarded for their yield per hectare, but also for their soil organic carbon. And these credits are being procured or purchased by retailers. And the whole idea is behind it, and that's why they call it insetting credits,
mm-hmm.
rather than carbon credits, is that if a retailer wants to offset its emission, let's say it's 1,000, you can buy carbon credits to offset that emission. Of course, you want to reduce, but that doesn't work overnight. So you start reducing, but then you want to offset the remainder with carbon credits, which you can buy on the open market.
Yeah.
And the idea is, okay, but suppose that within your own supply chain, you have farmers who provide you with food, who actually sequester carbon from the atmosphere in deep soil organic carbon, then you don't only emit, but you also capture carbon, and you can deduct that from your emission. So rather than having to offset 1,000 tons, you only have to offset 800 tons. So retailers keep money in the pocket. Well, if they can share that story in the market and share the idea that this particular mango or avocado comes from a farm that is supported by the retailer to financially to sequester carbon dioxide from the atmosphere in soil organic carbon, a farmer who contributes to a green cover or intercropping schemes or other management practices that contribute, or regenerative farming practices that contribute to mitigating climate change, then they believe they have a great story. Hmm. If they then can communicate additional collateral benefits, such as water holding capacity goes up, biodiversity is benefiting from it, well, that seems to work.
Hmm. So look, I'm going to take a step back and make sure I completely comprehend. So the retailers get to double dip here, right? They can inset their carbon. They can basically be involved in this process of changing things, of reducing carbon, because they're now sinking this into the production lands. The producers can sell these directly as another crop coming from their farm by taking the appropriate methodology, using this predefined KPI, this key performance indicator, which is the soil health coming from a couple different, I'm sure there's a multitude of assessments of what the humus level is in the soil and what that really represents.
Yeah.
So my question then is, if we going back to your point before, which is, you know, the farmer saying, well, I can't be green if I'm going to be red here. Who's helping them on the capacity building side of that? Who is taking the different methodology to grow based off soil health, to commit towards regenerative, which is a transition process away from the minerals? Are you seeing politicians? Are you seeing those subsidies come into play to help be that kick in the butt to move people in the right direction here and really cross that chasm to get people engaged? Is there anything like that happening?
Yes and no. So for the moment, we send our agronomists, our own agronomists or agronomists from Rodale or from other research stations to advise growers on their regenerative farming practices.
Sure.
Secondly, we keep this within our own supply chain, so we sell these insetting credits to the retailers who buy the cash crops as
yeah.
well.
Yeah.
So that's a nice story. It's a win-win because you also get some sort of exclusivity by doing that because not everybody is doing it. So it's a nice USP for the grower that secures a long-term relationship with retailers. And then to your other point, to what extent does the public sector accommodate this? Not yet. That's where the gap comes in. But within the Green Deal, people are working on a framework for carbon farming, as you may be aware. So it's a matter of time, not if it will arrive, but when it will arrive. And I mean, everybody agrees that land after the oceans is the biggest carbon sink. Not just a provider of food and health and water retention and climate proofness, but also a big carbon sink, except that our whole agri-food system is not geared towards contributing to that. It's actually geared towards exploiting that, which is very stupid. And that's recognized by the European Green Deal folks who are working on this carbon farming framework and obviously cutting back on mineral fertilizer and pesticides helps, but that's sort of reducing the bad stuff. And on top of that, they are encouraging growers with subsidy incentives and fiscal incentives to start building soils again. So again, it's a matter of time. It's not there yet, though. And we need it's like a dialogue between the private and the public sector. We need to deliver prototypes that can deliver proof of concept, which is precisely what we're doing.
The tip of the spear. I love it. Always innovating, Volkert. So last question here related to that, and then empowerment discussion for the end users or even for the public sector who are looking to empower better life expectancies for those consumers. Maybe you can share a bit about the Better Life Index and what that represents.
Yeah, thank you for asking, Aaron. That Better Life Index is based on the idea that the yardstick to measure wealth is outdated because we only look at financial capital. And the assumption of the Better Life Index is that we should also look at human, social, and natural capital if you want to talk true health or true wealth of a country. And interesting enough, it's not just Jacinda Ardern from the Prime Minister in New Zealand, but also the Finnish Prime Minister, the Lithuanian, the Danish, the Swedish, the Norwegian, the Scottish Prime Minister, all females, by the way, all female prime ministers have formed a task force to develop this Better Life Index within the UN OECD. So it's a UN-based task force based on the performance indicators that the Better Life Index group developed. And it's not that they run their country yet on the basis of that Better Life Index, but it's like a shadow accounting. And with it comes the ex-tex fiscal renewal thing. Are you familiar with that?
No, please explain.
It's based on the idea that it's as simple as it is complicated, because the idea between of ex-tex is that you tax extracted value rather than added value, which makes total sense.
Right.
I mean, if you innovate, you're penalized with tax. If you work, you're penalized with tax.
Right.
It should be the other way around. If you extract value by polluting or contributing to a growing wealth gap, so then you extract value, so then you should be fiscally penalized.
Yeah.
Or if you extract minerals from the earth, that's okay, but then nobody else can do that anymore. So can you please pay?
Right.
So, extracted value would be taxed, which which would lead to a circular, would encourage a circular economy where you reuse materials and prevent your business from being polluting things. And so the big five, EY, KPMG, PwC, Deloitte, they have teamed up with the Better Life Index Task Force to see how a wealth model based on various capitals can be encouraged or team or connected with this XTAX approach, which is a revolutionary fiscal renewal thing. But, you know, it will take time. I don't expect this to sort of be reality tomorrow, but it's another sort of acupuncture point where things seem to be happening. And whilst the man or woman in the street won't see this yet, it is unavoidable. It's hanging over the market. And it's about, and we need a few more crises, and then it'll be there. You know, we need good prototypes, which can be scaled up once the shit hits the fan.
Yeah. It makes complete sense, and incentivizing people to have better behavior. I mean, only in longer horizon, maybe generationally, it's going to change things. I think it's an intriguing way to express and have, you know, more positive stories come out of this too, and keep that glass half full, which is ultimately the goal of that enlightenment engagement, that keeping people knowing that they can be part of this solution. So with that, maybe you could end here by giving us a call to action for 2023, a call to arms. What should we be working on here moving forward? What kind of empowerment can our listeners take for steps forward?
Well, I would say dream, dance, deliver, as opposed to fake, freeze, and fail. So we need prototypes. We need laboratories of change, which usually start with big dreams, and which you can't realize on your own. So you need to dance and team up with coalitions of the willing, and never knock on closed doors, because that's only frustrating and it depresses you.
Yeah.
So forget about those. You can knock a few times, but if the door doesn't open, don't bother. And put your energy into those that want to be part of that coalition of the willing, who want to be part of the solution rather than the problem. And then you deliver small prototypes where you just, based on the approach, built the bridge while crossing it. You know, don't plan too much ahead. Just start somewhere.
I love it.
Dream, dance, deliver.
Perfect. I love it. And I think there are more of that coalition of the willing as people become more aware. And there's
absolutely. You're one of the main pivots in many coalitions of the willing, I believe.
Yeah. Well, many, many hands will take this. Will take this forward. And so I appreciate, Volker, you taking the time to chat with us once again. This is wonderful, and always take something interesting out of these conversations. So thank you.
Well, thank you for having me, Aaron. Very good to see you again.
You as well.